Medieval Europe was a decidedly rural landscape, and the majority of the population lived in rural areas. Increasingly, however, over the course of the High and Late Medieval period, people migrated to cities, often seeking better economic opportunities. Those migrants included women who came both with their families and on their own. In today's podcast episode, I speak with Dr. Emily Hutchison about the city of Paris in the late medieval period and think about how the experiences of women who lived there were gendered. As we'll learn, Paris was the largest city in medieval Europe, with a population of around 200,000. We'll explore the various types of economic activities that women engaged in, some of the limitations they faced in their lives, as well as why it's important to consider women's urban experiences in terms of place and space. Dr. Emily J. Hutchison is Associate Professor of History at Mont Royal University in Calgary. She has published several articles in journals such as Gender and History, Speculum, the Journal of Medieval History, and Medieval History Journal, as well as numerous chapters and edited collections. In 2021, she published a chapter on Christine de Pizan's writings on voice, gender, and class, and in 2022, a story map on the environmental history of late medieval Paris. She is currently working on a project entitled A View from the Street, The Genderscapes of Late Medieval Paris, which examines how gender, space, and agency interact at street level. This project uses space and place theory and intersectional analysis, and it is funded by a Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada grant.
Hi, Emily. Thank you so much for agreeing to speak with me today. I've really been looking forward to our conversation and learning more about medieval Paris and the experiences of women who lived there. So Thanks so much again.
Very excited to be here. I love talking about Paris every chance I get. So it's certainly my great pleasure.
Before we delve into thinking about women's experiences in Paris, let's start with some context so we can get to know Paris as a city, as an urban space. So what was it like as a city in the late medieval period? Can you give us a sense of the size in terms of population, but also geographically what it was like?
Sure, absolutely. One thing to note is Paris was the largest city in Western Christendom at the time. Only Florence came anywhere close to it in terms of population density. Up to the Black Death, Paris was sitting somewhere around 200,000 people, we think, although of course we don't have any clear statistics, but that's the general assumption. The Black Death did devastate the city came in June 1348, and it lingered until early winter, and the population decreased accordingly. But we think it by around 1400, it had rebounded to a great extent and was somewhere around 150 to 180,000. There were walls around the city. So Paris is organized that there are three parts of the city. So the River Seine runs through it. There's the island in the center, which is the oldest part of the populated city, going all the way back to pre-Roman times. And then there's the left bank, which is on the southern shore, and the right bank, which is on the northern shore. They were called different things in the Middle Ages. Beyond Small Bridge was the left bank. Beyond the Great Bridge was the right bank, and Cité was the island. On the southern shores, there was one wall that was built by Philip Augustus around year 1200. And then on the right bank, he built a wall, which Charles V, at the end of the 14th century, he added another exterior wall because the city was spilling outside of Philip Augustus's. Historians have actually calculated, and the external walls in total were about 2.53 square kilometers. Wow. So that kind of gives you a sense of the scope of the city. And then in terms of its geography, the southern shore, the left bank, it was a high ground. There's what they called the Mountain of Mont-Saint-Geneviève, was one of their patron saints, and her abbey was at the top of that hill. And then as you come down towards the river, then the right bank was originally a marshland with a few hills, and there were settlements around those small, they're not even hills, they're more like mounds. And then outside of the city on the right bank were there are still very large hills, but they drained those marshes and eventually started building up the right bank. So that's the geography. I will say about the three zones, the separation was really important in the Middle Ages. People understood that city was organized into three separate parts. And like I said, one, the left bank was called Beyond the Small Bridge, but then by the somewhere in the 15th century, maybe early 16th, it started being called University, as in the university. The island was always called Cité, and then the right bank was called the city or La Ville. And you can see that on all the early modern maps that have been produced of Paris. And Victor Hugo, when he talks about Paris, he talks about those three zones.
Yeah, that gives me a really good sense of thinking about how it was divided into these different regions. The other thing I think that's important to remind students about cities is that cities don't just encompass the place within the walls. So can you talk a little bit about its relationship with the external part of the city?
For sure. So those were called the faubourgs, like suburbs. On the left bank, most of the people lived actually inside the walls on the left bank. There was the burg of Saint-Germain-des-Prés, and that was actually its own proper burg. So it wasn't subject to the rules and the laws of the city of Paris. It was under the lordship of the abbey. And there were a few satellite villages that were associated with Paris. So on the left bank, there was a really very small but densely populated village called, and there was also an abbey of Saint Victor. So there was a village that grew up around that. And then on the main highway coming in and out of the city on the left bank, there were pockets of settlements. So apart from the burg of Saint-Germain-des-Prés, all of the villages outside of the walls were subject to the laws of the city. And in fact, the king's main representative in the city, the provost of Paris, he was the provost of the city and also of the viscounty of Paris. So all of those villages fell under the king's lordship. Then on the right bank, there were all kinds of different villages, like there's Saint-Denis, where their patron saint was buried. Between Saint-Denis, where all the kings were buried, by the way, mm-hmm. in that abbey, there was the Landit Fair. So there's a meadow where this yearly fair took place every June. And then there were villages of Bellevue, which is still a village in Paris, and all these others. So there were certainly people who were living outside of the walls, and they would their products to market and so on. So there's a lot of interaction there.
I'm also an urban historian, and I think that's one of the things that I often have to remind my students about is, much like today where urban spaces have relationships with the countryside and there's people moving back and forth between those, it was the same thing in the Middle Ages too.
Yeah, absolutely. And constant traffic.
Yes. Think about how these are dense cities where there's lots of people moving around. So let's talk a little bit about that population. So who lived there? What was this population like?
Yeah, this is actually really important to understanding Paris and what's also what makes it unique to other cities, in at least in the French realm. So first to note is Paris was the capital city of the realm. It was called the capital city and it was permanent home to the king and the royal family. It was where the king's royal administration was located and everything was centralized out of Paris. So their high court, which was called the Parliament of Paris, not to be confused with English Parliament. So that's their highest court. And also the Royal Council met there. And some of those edifices actually are still standing today in Paris. Because the king was located there over the course of the Central Middle Ages, and especially by the period that I studied around 1400, a number of nobles had permanent residences in the city as well, especially the highest members of the nobility, mm-hmm. so the king's relatives. They all had these very expansive mansions and sometimes palaces mm-hmm. in the city as well. The city of Paris was also home to the Cathedral of Notre Dame, of course. So the bishop lived there and had a palace there. But the Archbishop of Sens, they also had a permanent residence in Paris. There were lots of different monasteries and abbeys located there. And then there was the University of Paris was located, all spread out mainly on the left bank. And if you look at my map, you see all the dozens and dozens of colleges where students and some of the poor doctors or masters might live when they first arrive in Paris. So the left bank was really densely populated with people associated with the university in some capacity. I would say of all the places in Paris in terms of gender ratio, it was probably heavily skewed male. Of course, there were people who lived there who weren't students, who were servicing the university in some capacity. So we have a lot of book binders, copyists, parchment makers, illuminators, and libraires who are clustered in various areas, tavern owners, people who are involved in various trades who could support that community. And then on the right bank, the reason why it became known as the La Ville, the city, is because that's where most of the merchant activity and crafts activity took place. So you can really think about the left bank as being mainly centered around the university and the city is where the city's government, which is called the Hanse of the Merchants of the Water, they have their building where they meet regularly and so on. And most of the ports were located on the right bank. You've got most tradespeople are clustered in the older part of the city, but like inside the earlier ramparts. So it's extremely densely populated there. Yeah. So a lot of the merchants and craftspeople are living and working on that side. You've got the Al, the main market of the city is on the right bank. There are other markets peppered throughout the city on the island and the left bank, but the Halle was the permanent covered market, and it's the most important and the biggest in the city. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then you've got most of those nobles, whether they're the greatest nobles or the lesser nobles, most of their homes are on the right bank as well, where the king is also living at that time. And then the island, you have the Notre Dame Cathedral, you have, I think, something like 20 parish churches in this very small space. And then the former royal palace was where the Parliament of Paris meets. It's still standing. So that's where they had one of their main prisons and royal council men and so on and so forth. So it's like an overview of the population.
Yeah.
Oh, and then the last thing I want to say is actually that Paris is actually a place of migrants. A lot of immigrants mm-hmm. come to Paris, and estimated that 78% of the population were actually immigrants to the city.
Wow.
Yeah. And Sharon Farmer's most recent book, The Silk Industries of Medieval Paris, her first chapter is called Paris, City of Immigrants. So that's really what it was. Who are the immigrants? Well, they're those students that we talked about, but they're also people who are coming from the countryside looking for better opportunities, working in various capacities as apprentices, as servants, as chambermaids, who are essentially coming there for those to better mm-hmm. their own circumstances. But then on top of that, this is a really important center of luxury trade. Mm-hmm. Especially silks, book illuminations, precious metals, and art, especially around 1400. So a lot of the migrants to the city are actually artists, musicians, involved somehow in the book trade, and highly skilled workers who can work either in the silk industry in some capacity or some other luxury trade. I think overall we could say that it's a super dynamic, very densely populated city. Although you do see on the map that there are some green spaces that were put aside for agricultural fields for the fruit and vegetable markets. But by and large, we're talking about like super densely populated urban space.
That's what I was going to comment on, was that it sounds really dynamic and very diverse. And I think for people that haven't had the chance to go to some of these European cities where the footprint is still very much like the medieval city, we don't really get a sense of how dense and how small and how windy these streets were. And yeah. Until you actually get the chance to go there and experience it, it's hard to imagine sometimes, I think.
Yeah, and that's one of the great things about Paris. I know that Haussmann destroyed a lot, especially on the island, barely anything remains. But especially on the left bank around the Latin Quarter, you can easily get lost in those windy streets. And then even on the right bank, even though there are a number of different boulevards that destroyed the old structure of the city, a lot of the old streets remain intact. And you can actually walk down them and you can get a sense of firstly how narrow they were, but also how labyrinth.
Yeah. Yeah. I always find that's one of the things I love about some European cities, is that some of them have maintained those medieval framework. Girona that I study, is the medieval city is completely preserved. Wow. And so you get a chance to walk around and see what it's like. And for those of you that are interested in Game of Thrones, Girona is featured in season 6. So you can get a sense of what it was like. So for this specific class, we're thinking about the urban experience in the medieval period and how it was gendered in particular. And you've highlighted a little bit about that in your discussion about the university area, which was predominantly masculine. But so let's start with some broad questions and then we'll get a little bit more focused. So what was it like to be a woman in late medieval Paris? Can you tell me a little bit about how living in that city would have been gendered? And what are some of the things that would have influenced their ability to live in an urban setting?
That's a really good question. Of course, like most questions, even if it's broad, it's complicated. And we'll talk more about this in a minute, I'm sure. But it really depended on who you were, what your status was, whether you were married or single, if you were poor, middle income, or wealthy. I'm going to only talk about non-nobles mm-hmm. today, actually, because I'm not interested at the moment in noble women's experiences. Mm-hmm. But so it depended also if you were Christian or Jewish. So from 1394, some of you may know that Charles VI expelled all Jews from the realm. So all Jews from Paris had to leave the city and from the realm. They didn't come back until I think the 17th century. There was that. Mm-hmm. But up until 1394, I think it's important to recognize that Christians sometimes worked for Jewish families and Jewish women sometimes worked for Christian families. There was anti-Semitism that was mm-hmm. circulating in the city, and that there were very frequently some violent flare-ups against mm-hmm. the Jewish population. So things that Christian women wouldn't have to worry about in the same mm-hmm. way. So I think we have to acknowledge that. Like at one point, 2 years before the Jews were expelled from the city and from the realm, Charles VI had to issue several ordinances reminding Parisians that the Jewish community was under his specific protection. So there's that. And then I also say about religion that I don't have any other evidence of any other religious communities in the city. I don't have any evidence that there was a significant or even a small Muslim population, for example. It doesn't mean there wasn't one. It just means that there's absolutely no evidence that I know of that survives to tell us anything about it. So either maybe there wasn't one, or maybe they were erased or ignored. It's hard to know. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't be able to speak to people from other religious communities. So I'm going to just focus on some general comments for Christian women across different status, wealth, and family status, and so on. I'll start with the good things that women look forward to. And it's not exactly unique for France, but it's good to know that women could own property and land. They could inherit property and land, and they could bequeath property and land and sell property and land as they chose. So they had total autonomy, whether they were married or single, and there were never any issues with that. Even if they were married, none of that property went into the hands of their husbands. And that's actually really important, because we know for some of the religious lay institutions, like there was a really large begging population in the city. And beggings didn't demand that their members give up their property the way that some lay orders did. But beggings, even while they were a part of this institution, they could do with their property what they willed.
Can I just interrupt for a second and get you to explain a begging?
Oh, so beggings are women who are religious women, but who haven't taken oaths that are necessary to enter into a monastic order. Okay. So they can continue if they're married, they can stay married. Okay. They don't have to live in an enclosed space in a monastery or abbey. They can continue with their professional jobs. So a lot of them are involved in the cloth industry, either as in the silk or the wool industry. They don't have to give up any of their property, but they are members of this religious order. And actually, the beggings in Paris are really interested in education. So a lot of beggings are lectured to from theologians from the University of Paris, but they're also involved in teaching young girls basic numeracy skills and stuff like that. So they're just a really important religious communities who are dedicated to Christian values and beliefs, but they also live in the real world.
Okay. Thank you.
The other thing to know about Paris is that guardianship was the rule, the general rule, that women were supposed to be under the legal guardianship of someone. But given that 78% of the population were migrants, a healthy dose of that number were women who migrated to the city and were working in various capacities as chambermaids or whatnot. And they came to Paris and they didn't have networks, so they didn't have guardians. And so one of the really interesting things I'm finding out about Paris is just how many single women I come across who are autonomously living their lives and don't necessarily meet some of those obstacles that I always assumed they would have to face. Like, we know in Paris that all women had the right to bring anything before the courts. They had the right to testify before the courts, testify on their own behalf, testify against people. But if you were married, you had to bring your husband. You could do that, but he had to be there in the room. But single women, they had a lot more freedom to bring these things to court. Could backfire on them, of course.
Yes.
Not having somebody stand behind them. But at least the fact that they could speak on their own without having somebody there, I think is something I hadn't. I know it's not that I didn't expect it. It's that I just assumed that all women had to have a guardian for all things. And I was pleasantly surprised. Married women were automatically under the guardianship of their husband, but like in other places in Europe, there was opportunities for their husbands to emancipate them legally. And so they would become femme souls. So we have a lot of women who become femme soul independent legally from their husbands so they can run their own businesses and they do so successfully. And that is also pretty normative in the city, as far as I can tell. Women running their own businesses, running their own market stalls in covered markets, renting these places on their own and running their workshops, sometimes as masters of different guilds. Yeah, so there was certainly some freedom for women in those ways. Women could join many of the guilds that were members of the Hands of the Merchants of the Water. Some of the guilds aren't clear if women were permitted or not, but their exclusion doesn't mean that they weren't permitted. So that's something I think we've traditionally read those sources the other way, that if they're not specifically mentioned, that they're not permitted to be members or apprentices of that particular trade. But I think current scholarship is flipping that a little bit, at least considering the option that women were allowed to participate in most trades. Now, some of the negatives that we have to acknowledge for women is that they were, of course, especially single women, far more vulnerable physically to violence. And there is actually a lot of violence against women that we can track in the city. First of all, there's a lot of spousal. A lot of the trial records that I read, one woman was beaten so badly by her husband with an orb of some kind that she had to spend 6 weeks in the hospital. She survived. Another woman was beaten so badly by her husband that her brother killed him. So a lot of sort of really aggressive spousal abuse. And Hannah Skoda, by the way, has written an interesting article on the ambivalence of spousal abuse and touches on some cases in Paris. And then I've noticed, especially in the trial records, that often women who were living by themselves or with other women who are not their family members were often targets, like premeditated targets of pretty awful violence, mostly sexual violence, men breaking into their homes and subjecting them to all kinds of horrors. And then there was a curfew in Paris, like elsewhere, and nobody was supposed to be on the streets after curfew, but especially not women. It's logical in a way, but also women who are found, there's a lot of victim blaming, of course, if they are found outside of their homes after curfew, and see that a lot in the records too. So there's that. And then the other thing that's not, Sharon Farmer has this great article on the glass ceiling in Paris, that women, you know, were involved in so many different crafts and trades where they had opportunities to build a really great important network, sometimes with very wealthy patrons through the cloth industry as an example. But one of the things we know for sure is that they were excluded from any administrative positions in the civic government. There are a few people who are appointed as inspectors of their trade in the guild regulations. But when you actually look at the salaries for inspectors that are paid for by the civic government, none of them are women. Right. So it might be 12 reputable men might survey the weighing of the wine, but never women. So there's that, the equivalent to the mayor, the equivalent to the alderman. These are all male positions. There's absolutely no way that women can be involved. All citizens who were members of the Hands of the Merchants of the Water, they owed the city time and the night watch. And women were not permitted to be involved in the night watch in any capacity. But that's something I want to come back to maybe a little later, but are they really full members if one of their major responsibilities is foreclosed to them? I don't know, but something that I'm interested in pursuing if I can. So there were limits to their involvement. A few scholars have suggested that at street level that women weren't involved in politics. I'm not so sure. This is actually something that I want to investigate further because I have some ideas about rethinking that a little bit. There's some snippets of evidence that suggest that they did go to assemblies that were held outside when it's a very politically volatile time. So that information was being shared in public spaces. And there's some evidence to suggest women went to those, whether or not they had a quote unquote vote. If they are full members of the guilds as masters in some cases, there's nothing that says that they can't have a vote when that community is called upon. I don't have any definitive answers, but I want to poke around a little bit more at.
I think your comments just show the complexity of this. There's a tendency to think that all women in medieval Europe, regardless of where they lived, experienced oppression because they were considered largely to be second-class citizens in comparison to men. But when you start to look at the fine details of their experiences, we see these moments where it's clear that they did have lots of opportunities and they exploited those opportunities, but at the same time that they also had limitations and that both of those can exist at the same time.
Yeah, and within the same particular space, they can have autonomy and freedom, and they can also be constrained in some ways. They're very involved in the social life of Paris too. And something that, again, I think often gets overlooked, that they're very heavily involved in the confraternities, again, with their male neighbors and their male relatives. They're very involved in donations to the churches. And there's lots of evidence of them participating really quite actively in a lot of social events like that, or processions that are going through the city and that kind of thing. I think it's really important to recognize that the invisibility of women in Paris is, it's a product in some ways of our source material, which is something that I want to address in my book, but it's also the product of some significant prejudices on the part of historians over the last few centuries. I'm just not willing to look. That's certainly something that I'm trying to do with.
I'll tell a little anecdote before we move on to the question. When I first went to Valencia to do my research for my dissertation, I had coffee with some of the senior historians from the University of Valencia. And I told them what I was working on, which was looking at women in marriage in medieval Valencia. And one of them said to me, "How are you going to do that? There's no women in the records." And the meantime, I was drowning in sources. I had so many sources. I didn't know what to do with it. And I thought, this is the attitude of that. They're like, no wonder I'm the first person to write about this. And they had that perspective. I think that was a perspective that was held for a long time. Women don't exist in these sources at all.
It's too much work and
yes,
probably impossible yes. work. And so let's yes. just give up.
So we've already started thinking about this already. But as you mentioned, you know, women is this really broad category and women's experiences are really impacted by their socioeconomic status, by their religion, by their family background, all kinds of different things. Much like today, that's no different. So in this class, we're reading some material that you suggested, guild regulations from Paris workers. We're also reading the trial of Jacoba Felice for unlawful medical practice. And obviously the lives of these guild workers would be different from the life of Jacoba Felice, but both of them were engaged in economic activity of various kinds. So what type of work did women do in these urban settings? And how would their work lives be different, but from, say, peasant women who made up the majority of women in medieval Europe?
Yeah, such a great question. And yeah. I'll try not to talk too long.
Okay.
I have so much to say. So I'll try to be pointed in my response, but there's just so much. And I'm so excited about this material. I'll start with Jacoba. So one of the things that source points to that I hope everyone noticed is that she was in high demand, at least according to the trial.
Yeah.
And that those three witnesses who give their testimony like indicate that she had a reputation for great healing. So Jacoba, she was at least a little bit in demand. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that we note about her is that she's moving all across the city, right? So she's not just in high demand on the left bank or on the Cité. Those three witnesses, two of them are on the right bank and one's on Cité. Right. Mm-hmm. I don't know where Jacoba lived, unfortunately.
Yeah. That'd
be good to know.
But,
you know, but that she's in such high demand that they're finding her and they know where to find her. That's also something that's not said, but they know where to find her and they bring her to these places and that she's moving all around the city. So when that one woman was in the hospital at Saint-Sulpice, which you'll see on the map is just very close to the left bank walls and also to the burg of Saint-Germain-des-Prés, very far from where she lived. That Jacoba was visiting her every day.
Wow.
That's a lot of the time, those are details that we tend to ignore that I'm trying to pay more attention to. I thought it was important to flag, and this is where I think mapping, I'll tell you later more about it,
but yeah.
where I think mapping can really clarify a lot of things for us that remain hidden. Anyway, she was clearly successful, sought after, and highly reputable, and she's also really mobile. The same document actually points out Clémence de Belvaco as a maker of pewter pots. You can tell from the name, her husband at least is probably an immigrant, or maybe she was. And so when you look on the map, you'll see that she lived on the island, and she lived in a neighborhood that was dominated by pewter workers. It's really well known that pewter workers were located there. We have a lot of evidence of thefts of pewter pots and stuff in that area. It doesn't specify actually if her husband was a pewter pot maker, it just says she was, right? So that's also, I think, really important. That means that whether or not her husband was a pewter worker, that was her identity. Presumably that means she belonged to the guild of the pewter pot makers who were part of that Hanse of the Merchants of the Water. We don't know if she had her own workshop. We don't know if she was a master, but we know she was involved in the trade, absolutely. As I said, all of those guild people were supposed to participate in the night watch, but Clemence wouldn't be able to do that. So anyway, I raise these two points first because these are the kinds of details that often get overlooked and throwaway details that we tend to rush over. And what I'm trying to do is weave together all of these different threads so that we get a better sense of what women are up to. Women were actually engaged in the widest range of economic activities you can imagine. So a lot of work been done on women who are involved in the book trade in some capacity, parchment makers alongside their husbands and their sons, sometimes owning their own shops, a lot of illuminators working alongside their husbands, a lot of copyists. Christina Pizan makes reference to an illuminator, Anastasia, who she says is the best in all of the city. So women are really heavily involved in that. I'm finding lots of evidence, not just in textuals as people I've used before, but other evidence to show that women were goldsmiths, like Clemence, were identified as being goldsmiths, not that their husbands were goldsmiths,
but they themselves. They were goldsmiths,
which is a really important luxury trade. And those people were quite wealthy. Women were spicers, women were laundresses, of course. There's hairstylists. Yeah. They were involved in the lumber trade. I've got some evidence of that alongside their husbands. I have an ordinance saying that barber surgeons, both male and female, can no longer dump their blood from the bloodletting into the River Seine. So women are involved yeah. in everything, basically. The only thing, as far as I can tell so far, that they weren't involved in was the carter trade. I can't yet find any evidence of that. And anything relating to loading and unloading at the ports. There's this wonderful PhD from Janet Archer that she uses the only surviving tax rolls we have from the turn of the 13th into the 14th century. And she estimated that 2/3 of the labor that women were doing was labor that was also in some way being done by, and then 1/3 of their labor that women did was somehow related to food, clothing, peddling, or personal services. She writes like laundry, hostelry. That gives us a sense of the range of things they do. They're involved in everything. And what's really interesting about those tax rolls is it's only like 60% of the whole population of Paris was too poor to actually pay the tax. So they're not even included. So this is like 40% of the population. And then when you look at the numbers, I haven't counted them all yet. But there's a substantial number of women who are paying taxes on their own, either as heads of households or heads of their own workshops. They're really actively involved in the economy in every single way.
This type of conversation, I think, is really important in undergraduate women's history courses, because a lot of my students come to this class with the assumption that, I'm not sure where they get it from, that women in the Middle Ages were at home, did domestic chores, and that was it. And one of the things that I always try to challenge in when I'm teaching about women's history in all my classes is that is wrong. Right? Yeah. Women did that, yes, but they also did lots of other things too.
Absolutely. And the reality is that middle income and higher income and very wealthy non-nobles in Paris, like, they didn't actually do housework. They had servants to do that kind of thing. Some of whom were women, but some of whom were not women. Yes. Right. And when it comes to those wealthier people, they're running households. And the Ménager de Paris, you're reading an excerpt, but if you read the whole book, he talks a lot about how she has to work with the manager of her house, who's a woman, Dame Agnes, I think. And he gives her clear instructions about how she, as his wife, has to take responsibility for dealing with people who are bringing products into the house, foodstuffs, and so on. He gives her advice on which butchers she might want to consider and visit. And even though she's not taking care of the housework, she's still managing the house alongside this other woman. There is certainly a lot of work that they're doing in the household, but a lot of the women who are in middling and maybe slightly higher income earning families, their workshops are part of their home. Mm-hmm. Right. So they're involved in the workshop, whatever it might be. If they're butchers, for example, they're heavily involved in the sale and the production of whatever it is they're selling. But then they're also involved in overseeing the household, whether or not they have servants. So they're very involved in everything. But there wasn't a strict division between, you know, the home and the public sphere.
Yeah. So in this conversation, you highlighted a little bit the work that you do and the methodology that you've been doing as a gender historian of medieval Paris. So can you talk about the type of historical sources that you use and how you examine them? One of the things that I've talked to my students about is the fact that as gender historians, our methodologies are different in some ways because we have to ask different questions and approach our sources differently. So can you give a sense of how you do that as a scholar?
Absolutely. So first thing I'll say is that I actually use a ton of different kinds of sources. Mm-hmm. There are a number of reasons for that. And one of the reasons is that women are harder to see in the sources. Mm-hmm. And so it is actually really important, especially if you're trying to write women's histories and write about their experiences, to use as broad a range, I think, of sources as we can get our hands on. And I'm not only interested in women's experiences, of course, I'm also interested in gender constructs and the interactions between men and women and people of other genders, and thinking about gender performativity. So again, I'm really interested in using as wide a range of sources that I can. But the sources that I've been using for the book that I'm writing, I'm mostly interested in capturing the footprint of men and women as they're interacting in particular spaces in the city, and especially women, but not only women. Mm. And so for me, it's been really helpful to use sources that speak about place and that tie people to place, because I'm trying to reconstruct their footprint both in a literal way and in a figurative way. So I use a lot of property dispute records. I use a lot of contracts when I can get my hands on them. Wills and testaments I find are really helpful. I use a lot of judicial records like letters of pardon, trial records. They are actually my favorite because they give a lot of detail about spaces in ways sometimes that the more formal ones don't. And they also give a lot of really useful insights into how people are using spaces. So I find those really exciting. Tax records are helpful, but they don't tell us a lot of stuff. They just tell us a few things, and they're not really from the period that I look at. But then I also look at literature. So I've been looking recently, I've been mapping out some poems about people who are, I call it ambulatory literature. So the poets are walking through the city and they're describing what they see, and they describe the women that they see, usually
interesting,
in hyper-sexualized ways, connecting them to space. And I use a lot of illuminations as well, even though they're really idealized. I'm actually really interested in how they're idealized and what they say about gender performativity in particular spaces. So I just use a lot of sources. And what I look for, the details that we tend to overlook, right? So I'm really interested in any time that a body is connected to a space. Whether that's a male body or whether that's a female body, I make note of that and I map it as if I can. And I do find that a lot of these sources are replete with details that most people don't pay attention to, because the trial records, for example, when they're describing an event that happened, they have to link it to place. They often link it to time as well. And then there's often, not always, but some description of what that space is like and then the activity that occurs within that space. And so I've been paying a lot of attention to that, and a lot of attention to what the court clerk and the tribunal consider to be places that are loaded with meaning that have gendered implications. So for example, a space that they might consider to be an inappropriate place for women, and how they write about women's occupation of that space, as opposed to how it might be described or is described if a man is using it at the very same time of day. So for example, like the fields. Anytime a woman is in the field, if she's not specifically working, there's an assumption that she's a sex trade worker, right? So I'm really interested in how those spaces are perceived and how documents like these reify those ideas about the space and who should be using it. And then I map all this stuff out. So I do the analysis that historians do, analyze the text and try to pull as much out from it as I can, understand its context, but then I map everything that I can. And what I think mapping is bringing to my analysis is it's illuminating a lot of details that would otherwise remain absolutely hidden. Now, I'm not the first to use mapping. Sharon Farmer has used it in her studies on the silk trade, and Roos used it when they were studying the book trade, as of many people who have followed in their wake. But what I'm finding is the more I can learn about people's mobility, like Jacoba, for example, instead of just thinking about the ideas that people present about the spaces for men, I can actually see if women are in fact, in reality, using those spaces. I've been learning a lot about networks that both men and women can form as a result of where they're located, either where they are working or living or both, what communities they're involved in, like confraternities and stuff. You can actually generate a sense of how involved they are in their communities by literally tracking their footprint. And I'm slowly learning more about how gender discourses that are operating at a abstract level, how they're actually being instantiated at street level. Mapping, I argue, is, for me, it's actually a form of evidence. It's a primary source and one that we don't usually think of in those ways. But for me, that's one of the arguments that I make from the outset in my book, that is integral to understanding gender relations and women's differentiated experiences. And we take it really seriously.
It's something that in my work with Alexandra that we've been thinking a lot about as well. And I think mapping can bring to historians things that, as you've said, that we haven't thought about, but particularly for women and women's relationships with men too, about where these spaces are. I noticed that recently I've been paying a lot closer attention to when places are mentioned, like how they're mentioned in relationship to people and things like that. So this all leads to this question of, and this term that I love that you've been using in your work, called genderscape, exploring the concept of Paris as a genderscape. So can you talk about what that term means? And I think you've already discussed why using this idea of spatial history is so important, but maybe introduce students to the concept of spatial history and then talk about what you mean by genderscape.
Absolutely. So historians have been interested in space for quite some time. I'm not going to go through the historiography, but essentially we've learned over the decades that space is meaningful, right? That place is imbued with meaning and it can be shaped through power discourses. Space and place can be exclusionary, for example, or it can be strengthening for a community. Mm-hmm. That essentially place is not neutral. It's never neutral. Mm-hmm. And also space is effective, as in it's we have emotional ties to space and place, and sound and space and time and space is actually really important to human existence. When we're in the mountains, for example, we might feel a way that we don't feel when we're here in the middle of the city of Calgary, or in your case, in the middle of Prince George, that the landscape that we're a part of is one thing, but then when you're in a built-up space, there are rules that are usually attached to that space. Some of them are written, some of them are unwritten, about who can be there at what times, why, and about what kinds of activities are occurring in those spaces. Historians have been interested in this for a long time, and I've been interested in it for a long time. I started using the concept of genderscape after I was reading some feminist geography this past summer. And for me, I had an epiphany, essentially, and I really want to introduce it to historians because I think it's such a useful way of conceptualizing a social landscape that is anchored to real space, right? Mm-hmm. The social landscape being the interactions between people of different genders, whether it's male, female, or there's many different genders, that genderscape talks about those interactions and not just discrete activities, but everything that is behind those discrete activities that's governing how people behave and how they present themselves within those spaces, who has power, who doesn't, how that power is articulated. All of that stuff is actually easy to visualize and to concretize when you start thinking about it as a genderscape. For me, I'm a very visual thinker, and I've been able to deal with these kind of abstract theories of space and place for a long time, but somehow the concept of genderscape just anchors it in a material way that I wasn't finding before. And so what I find is so great about genderscapes is that it deals with the material elements of space and what's happening, let's just for the sake of argument, between men and women. So the interactions, the activities that are going on, it's the material elements, and it enables us to examine the point of interaction between that material and the discursive. Right? That the power discourses that are operating in the background, the ideas about how that space ought to be, what values are dumped into that space. So for example, marketplace, there might be rules about who can sell what, where, what times. Women are often, in some of the medieval markets, they're often relegated to particular places. It's not exactly the case in Paris, but there is some of that. But they are relegated to inferior places, it seems, in some cases. And there are very clear rules about that in some cases. And then we actually see that the reality is very different from this quote unquote fiction that's being told about the space. And feminist geographers, rather, they refer to the discursive element as the fiction space, the space of fiction. And historians often say power discursive space. But I love this idea that you can investigate the two separately, as they do, feminist geographers, and then bring it back together and see how it's actually operating. You can actually look at that point of interaction. So I'm super excited about this. And one of the things it's allowing me to do is, in my first chapter, I'm looking at sources that create this fiction of Paris as a male space. So these poets, for example, who walk through Paris, and one of them, every woman he sees, she's anonymous. 9 times out of 10, she's sexualized in some way. Sometimes it's overtly, he's mentioning that she's a sex trade worker. Sometimes he's jokes about it. Sometimes when you map it out, as I've done, that because it's in front of a college, that he's inferring that she's there for the men. And then the second one is, it's the same poem essentially, but he's looking for his wife. He follows the same trajectory, and instead of sexualizing her outrightly, he visits all the same haunts, and he's finding people like, have you tried this red light street, and have you tried that, and he goes and looks for her in a monastery and asks the men if she's been to visit. So when you bet, he's basically doing the same thing, and then he eventually says he's leaving her to whatever man finds her because he can't find her anywhere. So I'm looking at sources like that, but I'm also looking at other descriptive sources of Paris from the period that I study that describe this as a male city, right? Essentially only men. One of them, the only women he mentions, is Christina Pizan, the queen, and a few anonymous tradespeople who are all beautiful, right? Every one of them is beautiful, but they're anonymous. Yeah. Meanwhile, he mentions by name artists, artisans, craftspeople, wealthy homeowners, nobles, right? They're all named. And same thing with those poems, by the way, like men are named, women are nameless, right? So my point is like the fictional space that they create is one thing, and it's had a profound impact on how historians have told the story of the city. But then when you actually start looking at the evidence we have and the mapping that we do of women's actual footprint in the city, it's so much different. And that's really what my work is about, is sort of thinking through the two things separately, but also layered on top of each other. And I just think it creates a lot of opportunities to think about a landscape as a social landscape, or interaction, and where we can problematize those ideas about how a space should be when we look at it alongside the realities. So sometimes it conforms, but a lot of times it doesn't. And all of that's very interesting.
And I think it helps to give us a better sense of what life was like.
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly.
In ways that just looking at documents and not thinking about it through this lens can't allow us to. So what advice would you give to a student who's interested in studying the history of women in medieval urban settings? Where should they start?
The first thing I would say, as somebody obsessed with spacey places, don't ignore the spaces they inhabit or move through or are active in. Pay attention to the place. And if you can, if you have the means, try to place it on a map.
Okay.
Because I think that those things can be really helpful for telling the story of the untold and illuminating the day-to-day life that so often goes unnoticed. And then I think that all women's historians, we just have to be really determined and persistent in looking at the sources in new ways. And I guess eschewing some of the old assumptions, like just because women aren't named in something doesn't mean that they weren't, you know, invited to be guild members, as an example. And some of those things we can't prove irrefutably, but we can start piecing together. The more we ask those kinds of questions and push the boundaries of what we know about women's activities, the more we can probably come to some clarity on it. Mm-hmm. So I guess I would say, don't take things at face value, really question it and question the way that historians have previously thought about that thing that you're looking at. Maybe sometimes it stands as it was, but sometimes we might be able to have a better sense of the reality if we ask, really, was it that way?
And I think that's great. I always tell my students, trust your instincts, right? Yeah. If your instincts are telling you that maybe not, you're probably right. Thank you so much for a really fascinating discussion. I learned a lot. And also you've inspired me to think more about my own work through spatial history too.
Oh, I'm very glad to hear that.